Hello and welcome to Food Talk Radio, coming to you from Vermont Law School in South Royalton, Vermont. On today's episode, Jack Hornicle brings us an expose on trail food and nutrition from a recent excursion along a portion of the Appalachian Trail. Members of the Food Radio Collective visit the recently opened Mad River Food Hub in Waitsfield to discuss self-processing for food entrepreneurs. Also on today's episode, an interview with Kathy Bacon, the owner and founder of Freedom Foods. This Randolph co-packing facility has just broken ground on a new expansion to their Randolph facility. The Friends of Fermentation visit Matt Cohen at Fiddlehead Brewery in Shelburne. But first on today's episode, we have Emily Lyons with this installment of Farm Bill Watch.
Hi, and welcome to Farm Bill Watch. Capitol Hill has been busy over the last 2 months working on a new five-year farm bill. On May 15th, the House Ag Committee passed their form of the Farm Bill. The proposed bill reforms more than 100 programs, including elimination of direct payments to farmers for commodity programs. The bill is similar to the bill passed by the committee last year and is expected to be debated on the floor of the House in June. A day earlier, on May 14th, the Senate Ag Committee approved their form of the Farm Bill. The bill is substantially similar to the bill passed by the Senate last year and includes reforms in commodity programs, nutritional assistance, crop insurance, dairy pricing policy, and conservation programs. Debate of the bill started on May 20th in the Senate and focused largely on nutrition funding, dairy policy, and crop insurance. Senators have filed approximately 200 amendments to the bill. The Senate rejected an amendment that would allow states to require labeling of genetically modified foods. Additionally, a bid to turn the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, over to the states was rejected by the Senate. An amendment requiring large farmers to pay higher premiums for crop insurance was added to the bill. This amendment is projected to affect 20,000 farmers and save $1 billion over the five-year span of the bill. These amendments and the bill will continue to be debated after the Memorial Day break. If the bill continues at this rate, the bill is likely to reach committee by late July. In other federal ag news, on May 13th, the Supreme Court decided Vernon Bowman, an Indiana soybean farmer, infringed upon Monsanto's patent for its herbicide-resistant soybeans. Bowman replanted second-generation seeds purchased from a grain elevator. Bowman argued that Monsanto's patent rights were exhausted once he bought the seeds, and his use of these commodity seeds was an expected use of the product. The doctrine of exhaustion holds that a patent holder's rights and a particular patent object are largely exhausted by an authorized sale of the object. Therefore, the purchaser has a free right to use and reuse the purchased copy of the invention. Monsanto argued that when Bowman planted the seeds, instead of purchasing new ones, he violated the technology agreements for the seeds. The Supreme Court agreed with Monsanto and held that patent exhaustion does not permit a farmer to reproduce patented seeds through planting and harvesting without the patent holder's permission. The court was likely influenced by the severe consequences of stifling innovation and technology development for Monsanto and other biotech companies. This means that farmers are not able to keep seeds with patented genes and plant them the next season. Bowman now faces approximately $84,000 in damages awarded to Monsanto by the district court.
A couple of weeks ago, as a necessary escape from the law school library, I decided to take a week-long hike along the Appalachian Trail. I went from Hanover, New Hampshire, to the summit of Mount Washington for a total of 110 miles. Out for 7 days, I could reasonably carry all of my provisions without needing to stop anywhere and resupply. But what foods should a hiker carry? I met some travelers along the way and asked them what they ate along the trail and why.
Dr. Huss.
Yeah, from Whitefield, New Hampshire, like the Pacific Crest Trail in 2012, last summer. Yeah, I try to obviously keep the packaging down to a minimum, canned beer over bottled beer. things that don't weigh much to package, breakfast bars, Belvita breakfast bars, things that are lightweight. This one so weighs 1.76 ounces and gives you 35 grams of carbs. Things that pack punches and taste decent are usually go-to. Peanut butter, Nutella, olive oil is one thing I also carried on the trail a lot. I pour that right into my tuna fish, stir it up, and pour it into soups. Did actually carry a little bit of cabbage on the trail, which is great for a wrap.
But everyone has different tastes. Another hiker describes a few of her favorites.
My trail name is Sunbeam, and I thru-hiked in 2008. I like to have high calories. I especially really enjoy Pop-Tarts of any variety. Pasta sides, those are always easy and good variety, and you can find them readily. Random things like ramen bombs, which are cooked ramen and instant mashed potatoes, and you mush them all together, and you get this glorious, gloopy, gross, delightful thing that sits well in your stomach for days. I wouldn't say my hiking foods are necessarily healthy by any means.
So it seems hikers have little regard for the nutritional content, other than calories, of the foods they carry. But without proper planning, a hiker could be left malnourished, or worse, dehydrated. Dr. Huss tells me about his source of important minerals and a quick method for water retention.
Chia seeds, which have great electrolytes, helps your body retain water for much longer. It sends it through the digestive tract versus the urinary tract. So your body actually retains, the chia seeds hold like 7 times the amount of their weight, I guess. So I mix it into water with a little bit of Gatorade powder. Shake that up and drink that along the trail as I was going all day long. It gives you calories, electrolytes like magnesium, calcium, good healthy stuff for you.
Another consideration is the timing of when to eat. Hikers eat much like hobbits, often. Sunbeam takes us through her typical day on the trail.
Normally I kind of like wake up in the morning, have some tea, and then I start out with cereal, bring cereal, and then instant milk. And kind of have that as my morning get up and go quickly. And then I kind of hike for usually about 2 hours, and then I have my my second breakfast, my Pop-Tarts. Kind of keeps me going on till lunch. And then lunch, usually I have like a bagel and meat, like meat stick or pepperoni or and cheese or peanut butter and jelly, or usually like a granola bar or some trail mix. And then I kind of go on until second lunch, which is usually about a Snickers bar. And then you go on to dinner once you finally get into camp. Whatever that is, and that's usually pasta sides or instant mashed potatoes, ramen, all those delightful things. And sometimes I throw chicken in there, because that's real exciting to add a little protein that doesn't weigh too much necessarily.
My meals sounded pretty familiar. Coffee and oatmeal for breakfast, Clif Bar for second breakfast, sesame sticks and cranberries for lunch, protein bar at the end of the hike, and ramen for dinner with a glass of emergency. Using the USDA's online calorie counter provided by their nutrition data laboratory, I crunched the numbers of my and Sunbeam's trail diet. Each day, we both took in about 2,500 calories, including 325 grams of carbohydrates, 85 grams of sugar, 80 grams of protein, and 85 grams of fat. While we were consuming more than double the amount of carbohydrates and 50% more protein than that recommended by the National Academy of Sciences Food and Nutrition Board, our calorie counts were dismal. According to a calorie calculator on hikerdude.com, which considers factors such as age, height, body weight, pack weight, total mileage, and total elevation gain, I found that I had burned roughly 3,750 calories a day, and while only consuming 2,500 calories, I was running a daily caloric deficit. After a week on the trail, that can leave a hiker hungry. Thus, the final, and some say most important consideration, is the town meal. What does one eat when the hike is complete?
I usually crave veggies and fruits and things like that because I try to eat as healthy as I can, eat as much of that stuff. So first town that we got into, we went and got some Mediterranean Greek food, and that was delicious.
Not surprisingly, Sunbeam had a different approach.
It started in North Carolina. I went into town and I could smell cheeseburgers the whole way as I was hiking down into town. And it was like kind of a long meandering hike, but all I could smell was cheeseburgers. And so to this day, like a bacon cheeseburger with big, gross, greasy fries is like my meal that I go to when I'm done with the hike, craving my protein and all sorts of grossness, but it's great.
Finishing my hike and dining at the Moat Mountain Smokehouse in North Conway, New Hampshire, I ordered using both of their advice. I began with a fresh salad, followed it with a bacon cheeseburger with fries, and washed it all down with cold house ales.
So we have 2 meat processing rooms. Both of them are closed cell foam insulated, save for the ceiling. We have not yet insulated the ceiling. They are cooled using an AC unit and a cool bot, that little red light box that you see there. So I can get that room down to about 48 degrees with 2 bodies moving in there.
That's Jacob Finson, facility manager of Mad River Food Hub. He sat down with us after a tour, joined by founder Robin Morris, to answer a few questions about their new venture.
You're asking what other types of facilities like this there are.
Yeah.
So there are other similar facilities, but there's no other identical facilities. There are no other shared USDA facilities in the state.
And to the best of my knowledge, there's only one or two other shared USDA facilities in the country. So here we do vegetable value-added processing and meat processing, which is what makes us unique. That's our niche.
How many vendors do you have, or clients, or whatever you call them?
About 20 farmers and 20 value-added processors.
Yeah.
And some will just store boxes of bottles, and some will be coming in every week, storing food in the freezer, having food on the distribution truck. So we have services, and you just say, well, I have one of those services, one of those, and one of those. It's whatever helps your business.
What did you have to go through legally to start this?
We're an L3C. Well, L3C is an LLC, and you have to have an educational social component. So once we set up the corporation, it was a question of getting the most important permit for this operation was the wastewater permit. You can't do anything without a wastewater permit. You can't get a health department license. You can't get a grant of inspection. Mm-hmm. If you don't have the right wastewater permit license, you are dead in the water. So after that,
for the state, as well as for USDA inspection, the base of what you need to meet requirement is very simple. There's floor, ceiling, four walls, impervious to moisture, and hot and cold running water, and what they call adequate lighting. And you have to do a water test. You have to have potable water. Beyond that, once the facility was up to snuff, we had started in with hazard analysis plans, that identifying every step and assessing for hazards.
I tried to read both the modernization new acts, the food safety, and then the farming aggregation one. And it's a disaster for food hubs because you fit in every category, so you would have to, I mean, there would be registration up the walls. You would have to fill the room with paper.
Food hubs are in the center of a problem for the Food Modernization Act. The FDA are really screwed up. They don't have a process yet for food hubs. So although we have a processing center here, we don't process any food. A customer who comes in here, who processes here, doesn't have to register.
What are the qualifications that a business would have to meet in order to be able to rent a room? Or I guess a person would need to meet. Mm-hmm. Do they have to be incorporated?
They don't have to be. It's actually very little that we require from people. There are food business incubators that require business plans and require safety trainings and stuff. We want to be more flexible with people. We're a very, very small business incubator, incubating very, very small businesses. It's not financially feasible for many of them to just run out and buy all of the equipment that they need, let alone consult with business planners. We do an intake evaluation with new customers, charge $65. They come in, they do a four-hour production. During that time, I'll sketch out a flow chart of their process if I have to create a hazard analysis plan to go along with their product, which gets them a head start there. And is a huge savings to have someone build you a hazard analysis plan. Can be, you know, upwards of $20,000. We do that for free just because you're not going to start a business if you don't have it, if you need it. From a regulatory standpoint, if someone is processing meat, since we're the holders of the meat processing license, all we require is that they have $1 million liability insurance, which is not a very expensive policy. Those people also have to have a commercial processor's license, which is like $200 for the year. So essentially, they need to be licensed with the health department and carry insurance. If you can meet those two requirements, and you're not going to stab yourself to death while you're cooking, then you can work here. So we try to limit the barriers to access.
We're really focused on, I'm going to use the word, real food processors or producers, people who see that as their destiny rather than hobbyists.
Right.
So we don't take deer yet.
Yet.
You know, we're really focused on getting food out there that's eaten every day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what I call real food. You know, we're only in 18 months, and, you know, to be doing as well as we're doing, we're pretty pleased. But, could, you know, like your report card, could do better if they applied themselves.
Do you expect to see a big increase in how many people come in to process?
We want to see a big increase.
And we're starting to see, I guess, more diversification in the types of customers we're having. When we started, it was, you know, just a few value-added producers, and farmers wanted their goods processed, but they wanted to process for them.
Mm-hmm.
Because farmers don't have a lot of time.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were doing co-packing for people. Now we're actually seeing some farmers start to come in and do their own value-added sausage making, for instance.
What does co-packing mean?
Processing for you, cooperative, as opposed to you doing it yourself, which is what we built the place for, was for people to come in and do it themselves. We had a lot of farmers saying, we need a place to come do this.
So you build them a place, and then they say, we don't have the time to do it.
Or we don't know how to do it.
Right. Well, no, we can fix we don't know how to do it.
Right.
If you want to do it. Mm-hmm. But you have to want to do it.
Right.
So how does someone, a small producer or even a backyard farmer who wants to process some stuff, how do they get involved?
496-3100. Ask for Jacob.
Call or email.
Look at the website, www.madriverfoodhub.com. Everything's on there.
But what happens when a small fruit entrepreneur finds success? Kathy Bacon, owner of co-packing facility Freedom Foods in Randolph, Vermont, sits down to tell me about the challenges of a growing business.
A company in Vermont that might be making jelly, for example, in their kitchen and had success and can't make it in the kitchen anymore, might go to a shared use facility and make some slightly larger batches there and start to step it up a little bit. But if their plan for their company was to continue to grow and to expand, at some point they might reach a ceiling where having a shared use facility or using their own labor pool to make that product doesn't become sustainable for them, and they would then potentially look for a co-packer, and then they would be able to focus on the sales and marketing and management of their product line. My own in-house brands are certainly that evolution of kitchen to shared facility to dedicated facility, and I used contract co-packers in the interim from my kitchen to having my own facility. And then we have a number of clients that have made it through those steps as well. So we have what we refer to as in-house brands. So the brands that I own, Vermont Morning, Hillside Lane Farm, Funlicious Foods, Maple Fusions, Vermont Maple Passions, Body Syrups, and a few other items are my brands or my formulations and my recipes. Okay. And they are made at Freedom Foods. And then our clients that come to us may be under two different programs. Essentially, they could be a private label client. So a private label client would come to Freedom Foods and contract with us to take one of my formulations, in essence, and make it, but put somebody else's name on it. Or a client comes to us with their formulation, their recipe, they've been working on it in their kitchen. They want to bring it out to market and start to sell it, but they know they need to be in a licensed facility. Or they don't even know how to make it at that quantity. They don't understand the food regulations, the food safety, ingredient sourcing, costing, packaging, and anything else that may go along with that. So they contract with us to make it for them.
That's where your employees come in. They take the recipe and amplify it.
Yep.
And then produce it.
So we would work with a new client upscaling the recipe. So if it, you know, if someone said the most I've ever made before was 2 jars at a time, but we need to make 5,000 jars at a time, there's generally different processes and things that go along with that. And my customers, our clients, can come in and work beside us in a production room. So you're more than happy. We'll put you in a coat and a hairnet and everything to be there. But our facility is not designed for somebody to contract and come in and operate by themselves. Hmm. Actually, they can't.
Yeah.
You have to use our trained team. There's also food safety measures that need to be addressed. There also can be some regulatory filings that need to take place depending on the type of food it is. There are regulations for certification or registration of certain types of things, so we would take care of that. The Food Safety Modernization Acts and the different things that are happening in the industry are certainly all designed to protect the consumers, but it also does create issues for compliance for companies that are looking to expand or launch their product line.
Do clients with their own products and recipes specify where they want their ingredients sourced from, or is it just sort of up to you to pull it all together?
Whenever possible, agricultural ingredients are sourced locally. Any dairy, cheeses, apples, maple syrup, obviously, vegetables and things that are possible are either contracted with local farmers or with local food service distributors to bring that in locally. And most of our clients that travel here to have their products made, one of their primary objectives for their line is to maximize the use of locally sourced ingredients as well. Mm-hmm. So for some products that we make, it presents a very large economic opportunity for a local company to be able to look at providing all the maple syrup for a line that may have been previously manufactured someplace else.
And where do you, most of your clients come from?
Our clients come from all sections of the United States and into Canada at this point. We receive anywhere from 2 to 10 business calls a week. We have a zero marketing budget. We have a pathetic website. We have no Facebook. We've never tweeted. And we don't blog. And we don't advertise.
You're doing something right.
We have a waiting list for clients to come in at this point, depending on what their needs are.
What's the scale of the new facility compared to the existing facility?
Our existing facility is 7,800 square feet, and we do a great job with output from that space. Our new facility is 25,000 square feet. Our new facility has 13 production rooms. It has full washdown from ceiling to floor. It is energy efficient. It uses various heat reclamation. It has skylights and temperature control and fresh air, positive air pressures into each room. So it will address just about every operational deficiency that our current team is challenged with in our location, and it is set up to continue to allow us to grow as we move forward. We already know we'll be moving into flash freezing at our new facilities. We will be moving towards USDA inspection and certification, so our new facility will be capable of processing value-added meat and seafood. Mm-hmm. We're dramatically expanding our baking operations, like by 6 or 7 times the amount, and our wet processing as well.
Did you have a backup plan for other, you had other facilities that you were looking at?
If the town of Randolph was not a willing partner to keep Freedom Foods in the community, then we would have relocated to another town or city in ideally central Vermont. But that being said, almost all of my employees are from Randolph, and many of our employees walk to work. For some of them, if we relocated the business outside of Randolph, it would not have been feasible for them to easily continue employment with the company.
When do you break ground, and when do you expect doors to open?
We broke ground already, so okay. The governor was in Randolph a few weeks ago, and dignitaries were here to celebrate the announcement, and I would hope we'll be in our facility no later than the beginning of November.
Well, thanks very much for your time.
Excellent. Other people's pushing.
So this beer was brewed yesterday. So it's 18 hours old, and it's undergoing what's called primary fermentation right now. And the yeast that we pitch about a pound of yeast per barrel, so there's 30 pounds of yeast in there. The yeast are now kind of moving around, and they're starting to consume the sugars, and sugar goes in one side and alcohol and carbon dioxide come out the other side, and that's what we hear right now. That's CO2 that's being excreted by the yeast that's going into out of a blow-off tube into a bucket of sanitized water to prevent any type of contaminations from going back up into the tank.
Very cool. That's all blow-off.
So
we're here with Mattio, Fiddlehead Brewery, formerly of many other great breweries, and it's thank you so much. It's really an honor and a pleasure to start off our show with you.
Yeah, thank you very much for including me.
So you opened up on New Year's Eve 2010 into 2011.
That's correct.
So we're at a month and a year so far.
Yeah.
And I think you've gotten off to pretty astounding success, right?
Yeah, when I set out to start the brewery, as with any business, I wrote a business plan. My business plan called for 500 barrels to be produced the first year. I did about 1,600, so it was a very successful first year. And the second year, in 2013, we're hoping to do about 3,500.
Wow. So what is a craft brewery then? Because we were just talking about Sam Adams. Mm-hmm. Pretty big brewery by craft standards. Tiny brewery by macro brewery standards.
But they still do qualify for that craft label.
Absolutely.
There's some tension about that.
Yeah, well, we need them. Because if we take their numbers out, our numbers don't look so good.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is. And even my former employer, Magic Hat, they're not a craft brewery anymore, according to the definition.
Yeah.
I think the industry is in a real interesting place right now. 20 years ago, there were just these small little breweries that started up. But now these small little tiny breweries have kind of grown into these larger breweries, and they're starting to look and act and sell beer in similar fashion to the big guys. So I wish I had a crystal ball and could predict where it was headed, but there's definitely a renewed interest in smaller producers, and that's one of the reasons why I set out to start Fiddlehead. And when I first started working at Magic Hat, we were doing a beer called Blind Faith, which was an IPA. At the time, it was quite a hoppy IPA, and it was 35 IBUs. Today, 35 IBUs wouldn't nothing. Even be a pale ale. So just in that short, you know, the last 10 years, people have really been able to tolerate a lot higher threshold of hops, and they're really looking for bigger styles and more obscure styles.
You spoke about how many like things are trendy and new styles, and there really is a lot blowing up with like every few months, either it's Oak Aged or Brett Macy's.
Yeah, those are the beers that get the attention, and there's a very small minority out there. They're a very vocal minority, and these are people that are either hardcore craft beer consumer. Hitting the blogs, these are the people that are writing about beer. But the reality is, in order to be successful, you really need a flagship beer that's very drinkable. And unfortunately, these aren't the beers that are getting a lot of press, and they're not the beers that people are raving about, but they're the beers that people are buying, and they're the beers that people are drinking. You know, we just said 5%, only 5% of the total market share drinks craft beer. We're not going to grow that with double IPAs and Belgian triples and Imperial Stouts. The only way that we're going to bring more people into the craft beer fold is by making these well-balanced, accessible, flavorful beers. So I try not to get involved too much in trends. There's a time and a place for every style of beer. But for me, what I strive to produce is well-balanced, crafted beers that are easily accessible to a wide range of people.
What's going on in the Vermont market right now? So, I mean, Heady Topper,
yeah,
double IPA,
yeah,
they're holding it down.
They've done a fantastic job at really capturing people's imagination. Right now, that seems to be the hot style. What I am seeing on a personal level is a renewed interest, if you will, in balanced, drinkable session beers.
Yeah.
And I don't want to be drinking an 8% beer all night.
Yeah, what's the ABV on your double?
It's 8.5%. More of a beer for the people.
For sure.
That's not a beer that I would go out and seek out. Doesn't mean I can't make one, you know?
How do you choose your hop combos? I mean, because there's so many hops now that are on the market. Do you do small batches and experiment, or do you just...
No, throughout my years, I've worked with a lot of varieties. Every year, it seems like there's new varieties coming out. Yeah, New Zealand, Australia, they're excited about producing different and new style of hops down there. Most of the time, I can just read about it. But really, it comes down to, you know, throwing it in the kettle and seeing what you get. And that's the fun part about it, and that's really the art. A big piece of the puzzle right now is availability. A few years back, we had a hop crisis in the industry. It was kind of a perfect storm between the amount that had been harvested. There was there was some droughts in some key growing regions, and then there was the demand piece from the American craft brewer and other craft brewers throughout the world. So you really had to become creative, and I think that was an important lesson to the industry, because before that, I mean, you were hearing about people, they would dry hop their mash water, they would dry hops a louder ton, they would put hops in everywhere. It was a time of excess, and all of a sudden the crisis happened, and people realized that, you know, we need to be more responsible with the raw materials we have. But yeah, and I really think the art is finding that balance between malt and hops and being able to showcase all the raw materials.
What's your favorite beer that you don't brew?
My favorite beer in the world is Rodenbach Grand Cru.
Ooh, we were just talking about
yeah.
That.
Yeah. It's for those of you in listening land that haven't had an opportunity to try it, it's to me, it's kind of the marriage between wine and beer. I've been drinking it for 10 years. Every time I drink it, you taste something different and new. So it's so deep and so complex.
Well, thank you so much for having us and
showing
us everything. Congratulations on your
thank
success
you.
And make some great beer.
All right, we'll do that.
That does it for this episode of Food Talk Radio. As always, this has been a production of the Food Radio Collective at Vermont Law School. Contributions for this episode came from Will Duane, Emily Lane, Emily Lyons, Emma Hempstead, Jack Hornicle, Noah Sapsi, and our faculty advisor is Lori Restino. Please check us out on iTunes. You could subscribe by searching for Food Talk Radio. And you can follow us on Twitter. We are at VT Food Radio. Music on today's episode has come from Anamanaguchi, Litter Party, and playing us out tonight is Hank Micknock. Food Talk Radio. Farm, table, and everything in between.
I broke your window when I came down to your house. And I shone white. white